Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into what is, well, really a regulatory revolution happening in the European Union, specifically in agriculture. The promise is enormous. We're talking about next-generation crops, ones that are climate resilient, give higher yields, and drastically cut the need for chemicals, pesticides, fertilizers, all of that.
It really does sound like the perfect scenario, doesn't it? For food security, for climate change mitigation. But getting there means threading this incredibly complicated needle of EU regulation. And what's fascinating here is that after years and years of debate, they finally reached a major provisional political agreement on these new genomic techniques, NGTs.
Exactly. And this is a massive moment. This agreement is a genuine, a seismic shift away from the old, highly stringent legislation. The legislation that's, for a quarter century, basically kept GMOs out of the European food supply.
Right.
The whole goal, as the Parliament and the Council defined it, is to make the EU food system more secure, more sustainable, and to do that by embracing tech that gives us more resilient plants.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. You shared the source material, the details of this deal, and we need to cut through the complexity. We need to understand how the EU is trying to bring in, Nobel Prize-winning technology while somehow holding on to its famous environmental safeguards. That must have required some incredible political compromise.
Oh, absolutely. When you talk about compromise, you have to remember the history here. Europe has always been the home of the precautionary principle. The idea that if you can't prove something is perfectly safe, you just don't use it.
You just don't use it. Exactly. So moving away from that kind of blanket condemnation of all genetic modification, that required the parliament, which is often more environmentalist, to agree with the council, which often represents member states who are, worried about agricultural competitiveness. And the essential insight for you, the listener, is that the entire future of this tech in Europe now hinges on one single fundamental distinction. They didn't just loosen the rules, they created a whole new two-tier regulatory framework. And it's all based on how the genetic alteration was done.
That sets the stage perfectly. So
Right.
let's jump right into that. Section one, NGT1 versus NGT2.
Yeah.
This split is, it's the crucial starting point for understanding everything else in this deal.
Okay, so broadly speaking, NGTs are just advanced techniques that let scientists alter the genetic material of an organism with incredible precision. Unlike the older methods, the traditional GMOs, which often involved sort of randomly inserting foreign DNA, NGTs like CRISPR, they allow for these tiny targeted edits inside the organism's own DNA.
And that distinction, precision versus randomness, that's what's driving the whole new regulatory
It
approach.
is. The co-legislators agreed to split the plants into two categories. It's a way to separate the really targeted, what they see as low-risk edits, from the more complex, totally novel alterations.
And this is really the core of the whole agreement.
It is. It starts with NGT1, and these are defined as plants that, and this phrasing is absolutely vital, could also occur naturally or through conventional breeding.
That phrase is the regulatory key, isn't it? Because if NGT1 just mimics changes that might happen in a field over, a very long time through natural mutation or traditional trunk pollination,
The kind of thing farmers have been doing for centuries.
then they're considered lower risk.
And the regulatory consequence of that is, well, it's monumental. NGT1 plants will be exempt from most of the precautionary requirements of the old EU and GMO legislation.
So that means they get to skip that long, incredibly expensive risk assessment process that, it took years and really stifled innovation.
It's the innovation fast track, as long as you stay within those parameters of natural occurrence.
So, okay, let me see if I've got this. If I'm a breeder and I use an NGT to edit one single base pair in a rice plant to make it drought resistant, and that specific edit is something that could have happened naturally over a few decades.
Then you qualify. You get NGT1 status and the lighter regulatory touch.
But that raises a huge question, doesn't it? How do regulators actually check this? How do they determine what counts as natural occurrence? It can't just be a feeling.
No, it's not subjective at all. The commission has to establish very strict technical parameters. They'll look at the size of the modification, how many edits were made, and whether those specific edits could, credibly be achieved by conventional methods like mutagenesis or simple breeding.
So this is where the details really matter. It's not just a philosophical idea. There has to be a detailed framework to make sure only very, very targeted modifications get that exemption.
Exactly. And that brings us to NGT2, which is basically the catch-all category. It's defined as all other NGT plants.
Simple as that.
Simple as that. If the modification involves introducing foreign genes, or if it creates traits that can never happen naturally, or if it just crosses that technical threshold for complexity, it falls into this higher risk group.
And NGT2 then stays under the full umbrella of that precautionary principle.
Precisely. NGT2 plants will still be subject to the full rigorous rules of the existing GMO legislation. That means stringent, case-by-case risk assessments, full traceability, labeling, and a much, much longer authorization process.
So the EU is basically saying, for these complex non-natural changes, we are not backing down from our historical concern over unforeseen effects.
Yes. If we think about the strategic rationale, it's a very careful balancing act. They're trying to fast track the innovation that seems less risky, the nature mimicking edits, while keeping this really tight control over the major genetic alterations.
You had a great analogy for this earlier, which I think really helps ground it for everyone listening.
Oh, right. Think of NGT1 like a surgeon making one super precise stitch to fix a small tear in a piece of fabric. The result is something you could have achieved with very careful conventional tailoring.
Okay.
NGT2, on the other hand, is like replacing the fabric's entire fiber structure with some new synthetic material that has never existed in nature before.
It's completely novel. The risk of an unforeseen reaction is higher, so the need for intense scrutiny, for safety checks, that remains absolute.
And just to wrap up this section, it's important to note that these rules are global. The two-tier standard applies to plants from the EU and to imported plants.
So if a drought-resistant wheat developed in the U.S. wants to get into the European market,
it has to be classified first. Is it NGT1 or NGT2? And if it's NGT2, it faces all those old-school GMO hurdles.
That's a powerful standard to set for the rest of the world. But okay, now we have the definitions. The real breakthrough, the political masterstroke here, is in how the EU is channeling the application of the technology. So moving into Section 2, we have to talk about the crucial safeguards they built into the NGT1 category. Because being exempt doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. It means the EU is strictly dictating how NGTs can be used.
These safeguards are the reason the Parliament's environmental groups finally agreed to the deal. It was a successful push to make sure NGTs serve the green transition and sustainability, rather than just becoming another tool for big agricultural corporations.
So let's talk about the criteria for NGT1. Beyond just the technical stuff, the Parliament specifically demanded, and they got, an exclusionary list. A list of intended traits that are absolutely not allowed in NGT1 plants.
And if a trait is on this list, the plant automatically gets bumped up to NGT2 and faces the full regulatory burden. These are the red lines.
And the two forbidden traits are incredibly revealing. You cannot use NGT1 to develop plants with known insecticidal effects or, and this is the big one, tolerance to herbicides.
Let's pause on that herbicide tolerance part because that is where so much of the political and historical context is. This is the surprise factor. If NGT1 is supposed to fast-track innovation, why would you explicitly ban the traits that are most desirable to the massive chemical companies?
This seems counterintuitive, right?
It does, but it's because the EU is trying to stop history from repeating itself. The first generation of GMOs, you know, think of things like Roundup Ready crops. They weren't just designed to increase yield on their own. They were designed to tolerate specific herbicides, which allowed farmers to just spray huge amounts of chemicals to kill all the weeds without killing their crop.
Which, ironically, just led to more chemical use and then the development of superweeds that were resistant to those chemicals.
Yeah.
The whole system just became more and more reliant on chemical inputs.
Exactly. So by forbidding herbicide tolerance in NGT1, the EU is making a very clear statement. They're saying, we are not going to fast-track innovation that ties our farmers even more tightly to the chemical industry.
That is a really clever regulatory pivot. They're not banning the technology. They're channeling its application. By banning the development of chemical tolerance via NGT1, they're forcing R&D to focus on intrinsic plant resilience.
Right. If you can't make the plant tolerant to the chemical, you have to focus your NGT research on making the plant resistant to the pest or the drought itself. It steers the use of NGTs directly towards sustainability. Towards plants that resist drought, fight off fungus, and just inherently need fewer fertilizers and pesticides while still giving you a high yield.
It effectively marries the technological power of NGTs with the EU's big environmental goals.
Yeah.
It's like they're saying, if you want the NGT1 fast track, you have to contribute to the green transition.
And to make sure that happens, the regulation doesn't stop there. The Commission and member states have a very specific ongoing task. They have to actively monitor the sustainability impacts of NGT plants.
How does that work in practice? That sounds like a massive job.
It is, but it's crucial for accountability. They'll use data from existing official controls. So they'll be collecting information on input use pesticide and fertilizer consumption on farms growing NGT crops. They'll also be looking at biodiversity metrics.
So it's not a one-time approval. It's an ongoing promise to verify that the technology is actually reducing environmental harm and strengthening food security over time.
It gives them a mechanism to make sure the technology is fulfilling its green transition promise and not just, you know, creating unforeseen problems or just becoming business as usual chemical farming. This monitoring is the operational heart of the whole sustainability promise.
This push for sustainable, high-value traits then leads us to the next really complex question. If researchers develop this groundbreaking, drought-resistant wheat, who owns it? This is where the legal and economic interests collide. Section 3, intellectual property, patents, and fair access.
Well, innovation costs a lot of money, billions often, in research and development. So investors need protection, and that protection comes from patents. The deal allows patents for NGTs, which is vital. Without that guarantee of IP protection, large companies just won't fund the research.
That's the core economic reality, sure. But the source material also highlights the other side of that coin, the farmer. The EU has a long history of protecting small farmers and breeders, and genetic tech often threatens the traditional right of farmers to, you know, save and replant their own seeds.
And that tension is resolved with a few crucial safeguards that the members of European Parliament managed to get in there. First, there's an immediate exception. Patents are not allowed for traits or sequences that already exist in nature or are produced by traditional breeding.
That's a big one. It stops corporations from patenting fundamental biology that should really be in the public domain.
It's a huge victory for smaller breeders. But the real battle is about preventing market concentration, ensuring affordability, and protecting that historical right for farmers to save and replant seeds from their own harvest without getting sued.
Right.
And this is where the EU is trying to get ahead of the problem. They're building in mechanisms to mediate these conflicts before they explode. The main tool for this is the creation of an EU code of conduct on patents.
A code of conduct. What's the timeline on that, and why is it so important?
It's incredibly important because current IP law just wasn't designed for the precision of NGTs. The Commission has to draw up this code within 18 months of the regulation entering into force, which, you know, that 18-month deadline tells you they see this as extremely pressing.
So what is this code of conduct supposed to do for a small farmer specifically?
It tackles two critical issues. First, it has to set up rules for licensing patents under fair and reasonable conditions. Let's break that down. It means if a small breeder wants to use a patented NG2 trait to improve a local seed variety, the patent holder can't just charge a ridiculous price or impose unfair terms to block them out.
So it's a proactive measure against monopolies. It makes sure the tech is affordable and accessible, not just locked up by the biggest players.
Exactly. And the second purpose deals with a massive headache in modern farming: accidental infringement. The code must establish methods for the amicable settlement of patent disputes, especially in the case of unintentional minor presence of patented material in a farmer's fields.
That phrase, unintentional minor presence, seems really important. Can you give us a concrete example of why that's so protective?
Sure. Imagine a small farmer saving seeds from their own heritage field, and the big farm next door is growing a patented NGT1 crop. Due to wind or bees, a tiny, undetectable amount of that patented pollen drifts over.
Okay.
Later, when the small farmer tests their seeds, they might find a trace of the patented material. Without this code, that farmer could be facing an immediate, very expensive lawsuit for patent infringement just for saving their own seeds.
That would be terrifying for a small operator. So amicable settlement is basically a legal shield. It provides a way to resolve the issue without going to court when the contamination is minor and accidental. And it stops the farmer from being financially ruined by something they couldn't even control.
Yes, it prevents the immediate use of those aggressive legal tactics you sometimes see. It's the EU recognizing the reality of farming and building in protections for smallholders.
But what if the code of conduct doesn't work? I mean, it relies on cooperation. What if the licensing terms are still too high?
Well, the EU wisely built in an ultimate backstop. The agreement says that if a Commission impact assessment shows there are still significant barriers to accessing patented NGTs, meaning the code isn't working, then the Commission must take action.
And what kind of action are we talking about?
Real regulation. The action could involve further legislative measures to set up mandatory conditions if needed. This is the EU saying, we'll try self-regulation first, but if the market creates monopolies that threaten our food security or farmers' rights, we reserve the right to impose legally binding terms on patent holders.
That is a powerful check. It ensures this technology, which they see as a public good, can't just be locked away for private profit.
It's the political glue holding the whole IP section together. It protects innovation while trying to make sure the benefits are shared across the whole agricultural community.
Okay, so we've got the regulatory split, the sustainability demands, and the legal framework for IP. That brings us to Section 4, traceability, the organic sector, and the global reality of this tech. How will people actually know what you're dealing with?
Transparency is absolutely key, especially with Europe's history of consumer skepticism about genetic modification. So the EU wants to build trust by providing clarity, even for the fast-tracked NGT1s.
So for NGT1 plants, the ones that are mostly exempt from the old rules, there are still tracking requirements.
Yes. They have to be clearly indicated in all official national and EU databases. And this is key for the farmer. Seed bags for NGT1 plants must be explicitly labeled NGT1.
Okay, so this isn't a consumer label on the final food product. It's for the farmer, so they can make an informed choice.
Exactly. It's for professional transparency and for database tracking. Meanwhile, for NGT2s, the high-risk ones, full traceability and full consumer labeling remain mandatory.
And just like the old GMO rules, member states still have a lot of power over NGT2.
They do. The source material confirms countries can still restrict or prohibit the cultivation of NGT2s even after they're authorized at the EU level.
That opt-out clause for NGT2 is crucial, isn't it? It reflects how politically sensitive this is. It lets individual nations cater to their own agricultural policies or consumer anxieties.
It provides that political flexibility. It means the EU can move forward on authorizations, while a country that has, say, strong cultural opposition can still maintain a national ban on planting.
Now let's talk about a major group that has long been skeptical of all of this, the organic sector. How does this new law handle the relationship between cutting-edge genomics and the strict principles of organic farming?
The position is very clear. NGTs will not be allowed in organic production. The organic standards will remain strict and will exclude any techniques involving genetic modification, whether they mimic nature or not.
That maintains the integrity of the organic label, which is essential for consumer confidence. But as you said earlier, reality is messy.
It is. And this is where technical necessity comes in, especially with NGT1. Because NGT1 is defined as mimicking nature, the co-legislators agreed that the technically unavoidable presence of NGT1 plants would not count as non-compliance for an organic operator.
So, if an organic farmer does everything right, but a tiny bit of NGT1 pollen drifts into their field from miles away, they won't lose their certification.
Precisely. It's a pragmatic recognition that zero presence is basically impossible in an open environment. Without that exception, you'd effectively be banning organic farming anywhere near NGT1 cultivation, which would be devastating.
And the commission also has to look at the bigger picture, right? The broader impact on the organic sector.
Yes. They're tasked with assessing whether this regulation creates any administrative or economic burdens for organic operators. And that includes looking at potential negative impacts on consumer perception.
That's a critical point. Even if the presence is legally permitted, if consumers start seeing headlines about genetic material in organic products, they could do massive damage to the organic market's reputation.
It's a perception problem, absolutely. The EU has to monitor whether the presence of NGTs in the food supply negatively impacts consumer confidence in the organic label.
Okay, finally, let's bring this back to the global marketplace. While the EU has been debating NGT1 and NGT2 for years, the rest of the world has been moving fast.
We have to look outward to see the reality here. Several NGT products are already on the market outside the EU. It shows that while Europe has been carefully crafting its rules, the science has advanced to the point of commercialization elsewhere.
And the source material gives some real-world examples that show the kinds of benefits the EU is hoping to unlock with this.
Yeah, we're talking about things like corn, wheat, and rice varieties that need significantly less water. That's direct climate resilience. Imagine the impact of truly drought-resistant staple crops.
And even everyday things like bananas and mushrooms that have been edited so they don't brown as quickly. That directly reduces food waste.
These examples really highlight the tangible benefits the EU has been missing out on. The agreement is trying to close that gap by fast-tracking similar products under the NGT1 label.
The rapporteur, Jessica Pulfjord, she called this a historic day. She said it's a breakthrough that boosts not only our farmers' competitiveness, but also Europe's position in research and innovation. It's being framed as a huge step forward.
It certainly is. It moves the EU from a position of, well, near total stagnation on genetic engineering to one that's trying to be more nuanced, more risk-based, and to channel the technology toward public good.
So let's do a quick summary for you, the listener, to bring all these points together.
First, the foundation is the two-tier split. NGT1 is for plants that mimic nature, they get the fast track. NGT2 is for everything else, and it stays under the full, strict GMO rules.
Second, that NGT1 access isn't a free pass. It comes with a mandatory sustainability focus through an exclusionary list, specifically banning traits like herbicide tolerance to force R&D toward resilience.
Third, patents are allowed, but there are crucial safeguards for farmers. The right to save seeds, and an EU code of conduct to mediate legal fights over licensing fees and accidental contamination. And all of that is backed by the threat of mandatory regulation if it fails.
And finally, NGTs are banned from organic farming. But, crucially, the technically unavoidable presence of NGT1 is allowed, and the whole framework has to be monitored so it doesn't harm the organic sector's reputation.
Which brings us to the final and I think really important question as we look forward. This deal is provisional. Once it's formally endorsed and published, it enters into force 20 days later. But, and this is big but it, the actual application of the rules across member states will only begin 2 years later.
2 years. That is an eternity in biotech innovation. The pace of change is just accelerating.
Exactly. We already know NGT products like non-browning bananas and drought-resistant wheat are being sold outside the EU.
Yeah.
So what happens in the next 2 years as these technologies advance globally? And how will the EU's new, very specific NGT1 label be understood and accepted by its international trading partners?
Will the EU's strict NGT1 parameters become a kind of gold standard for sustainable genomics around the world? Or will that unique, complex designation just become a barrier when trading with countries like the US or Brazil or China, who might prefer a simpler approach?
That is the real challenge. The EU has solved its internal regulatory battle for now. But the next 2 years will define its place in the global food technology race. It's a race against time and a race for international acceptance.